again, everyone, and welcome to it. It's the Daily Caller podcast for the 11th day of September 2019. I'm Derek Hunter. I'm your host. Rigmarole, usual intro. Thank you for listening. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for telling a friend, spreading the word of mouth. I love getting the emails from you guys telling you how you're spreading the word to this person and that person and how you discovered the show. I have no idea how you discovered the show. So send those to me if you get a chance. I'm kind of curious, and I want to thank whoever turned you on to it. Lots of stuff to get to. Again, another action-packed day in the world in which we share this big, beautiful blue marble that is spinning around like a top. If you, by the way, a lot of you want to win the Sean Parnell books, the signed Sean Parnell books, and I don't blame you. Just email Derek, D-E-R-E-K, at dailycaller.com. Let me know that you want to be entered. I spent about an hour and a half yesterday answering emails, so I got all the entries for that one, and keep them coming. Going to do the drawing Thursday night, so you'll have until let's just say 10 p.m. Thursday to enter, and then you're out of luck. That's all there is to it. But until 10 p.m. Thursday, because I am in recording scheduled. Knock on wood. I hate jinxing it, but I want to say who it's going to be. But I can't say who it's going to be because I feel like I'll jinx it. But I am doing the interview tomorrow morning, which means I have to get up relatively early, actually really super early, like 6:30. So, yeah, it's going to be less sleep for me today. But still, the guest will be well worth it. I'll give you a hint. It's somebody who blurbed my book. If you know what a blurb is and you have my book, you look at the back of my book, it's one of those people. Supposed to be. Again, knock on wood. And you can email me compliments, complaints, whatever you want, whatever you got. We'll get in. I take them all. Recipes as well. I'm on the keto diet now. So I'm full-blown keto. So don't send me anything with bread or sugar or carbs. All right. You know, well, I'm trying to get healthy, though. You know, I'm a firm believer that when you're healthy, you're happy. And that's why I love our sponsor. And that's why I use CBD oil from our sponsor, AncientLifeOil.com. It's a natural remedy made with nothing but the purest ingredients and blended with coconut and hemp oils. I have the chocolate mint one. Tasty. I'm telling you, it's a home run hitter for your health. I was a skeptic, but now I see why it's so popular. I see why the athletes do it. I see why the weekend warriors do it. I see why the average person does it. I feel great. Ancient Life Oil is not going to get you high. It's non-psychoactive. It provides you the benefits without the high. So sorry about that if you're looking for the high. This just has the good stuff. I encourage you to do your own research. Go to your favorite search engine. Type in CBD oil benefits for yourself. Check out. See why thousands of people have made this a part of their daily routine. Check it out. Seriously. And if you don't buy it, if you don't believe it, you know, that's fine. But give it a shot. If you're curious, you've got nothing to lose. If you're ready to live your best life, go to AncientLifeOil.com now. The trusted source for the highest quality CBD oils. Ancient, A-N-C-I-E-N-T, LifeOil.com. And don't forget to use the promo code Derek, my name, at checkout and receive free shipping. AncientLifeOil.com. Love it. It really, it's amazing stuff. It's helped with my eye strain significantly, watching these computers all day. Speaking of watching computers all day, I'm sitting around watching kids all day running around and trying to keep them away from my computer. And suddenly, just before noon, the news breaks. Dun, dun, dun. The revelry goes off. The sirens are on. The horns are up. That John Bolton has left the White House. John Bolton, National Security Advisor. I've interviewed John Bolton several times in the past, though never on this program, although now he might be available. The news broke around 11:30 that John Bolton had either resigned or was fired by President Trump as National Security Advisor. And in typical bubble life, Washington, D.C. style, and I'm sure you saw this wherever you happen to live, the immediate story was he fired or did he resign? John Bolton insists that he resigned, President Trump insists that he fired him. Whatever the case is, does anybody really care? Honestly, I sit around, I think about this, and I wrote my town hall column about this in part, about how, who cares? This only matters in circles where the things that matter to normal human beings don't matter. What matters to real people is he's gone. That's it. If people knew who John Bolton was, and I know you guys do, but most people, I suspect, couldn't tell you if it were a Final Jeopardy question, or answer, I guess I should say that properly, they wouldn't know who the National Security Advisor is. They just wouldn't. They don't need to. That's why there's a National Security Advisor, so you don't have to do it. It's kind of a good thing. John Bolton was never a good fit in this administration. I really don't know why he was chosen, aside from the fact that he was popular on Fox News. And President Trump is a fan of Fox News. President Trump didn't run in circles of foreign policy experts or national security specialists. No, they didn't. Why would he? He was in the building business. He was in real estate. So when you see somebody who is widely respected by people you respect, you go, hey, maybe that guy would be good for the job. But Donald Trump ran in 2016 on a platform of getting us out of these wars, these endless wars. We're on year 18 of the war in Afghanistan. And John Bolton is a fan of the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq and most others. There's nothing wrong, and I'm not making a value judgment about either position, but oil and water don't mix. Although if you put, food coloring in with them, the food coloring mixes with, I think it's the water. And you put it in, I used to have an empty bottle of Absolut with like blue food coloring and water and oil in it. The food coloring mixes, I think, with the water in it. It just looks kind of like a poor man's lava lamp, except you have to shake it. But they really had no overlap or very little overlap, except in the fact that they both had and wanted what was in the best interest of the United States of America and its citizens. That was enough. John Bolton was in that job for 17 months, I think it was. It's a long enough time. But when it came to things like the situation in Afghanistan and President having had a meeting set up with Taliban leaders that he later called off, John Bolton clearly was against that. Personally, I was against it too. I would like to have seen those people dead rather than appeased in any way, shape, or form. And if we're going to get out of Afghanistan, I went out on rant about this the other day. If we're going to get out of Afghanistan, just get out. The Afghan people have had 18 years. If they can't get their act together after 18 years, then they deserve whatever oppression comes down upon them afterwards. If they want to revert back to the tribalism that's centuries old, knock yourself out. We gave you a chance. If you didn't avail yourself of it, it's not our fault. It's your fault. If you're not willing to fight for your freedom from an oppressive Islamist government, then that's on you. And if the Taliban starts welcoming terrorists again, we shouldn't only bomb the terrorist training camps like they had set up pre-9/11, but we should bomb the Taliban government. We should try and wipe them out. So what? They hate us anyway. What are they? Their kids are going to hate us even more? Do you think they're raising kids to love? They always say, and this is what drives me nuts, well, you kill one terrorist and you create another or more, two more or whatever. All the children of that terrorist will then become terrorists because you killed their parent. Like, well, so what? We'll kill them too, honestly. Or maybe we should just kill them. If you're hanging out with a terrorist, if you're going over to Osama bin Laden's house for dinner, but you're just a humble dentist who minds his own business and isn't really down with that blowing yourself up thing, tough, okay? If your dinner party happens to get blown up because you're eating dinner with Osama bin Laden, that's the choice you made. You know what Osama bin Laden is. So when you hang out with them, or when you hang out with any of these Taliban leaders, that's just the way it is. And what? Do you think that the Taliban leaders or Al-Qaeda leaders are raising their children to be respectful of other cultures and other countries and not be so harsh against the United States? But then, when they killed his father, that was the last straw. He was raised in a very tolerant life and environment in some backwood village in the mountains of Afghanistan, while his father was out trying to convince teenagers to blow themselves up in markets. Do you really think that that guy's going to raise kids who just goes, yeah, you know what, that was my dad's war. That's not for me. Oh, wait, they blew up my loving father who spent his life trying to kill people? Well, that's a bridge too far. Now I must turn to a life of terrorism. I have no doubt that terrorism, killing terrorists, pisses off some people who care about them and then could lead them to more terrorism. But let's not pretend that it was a choice. They came to a fork in a road upon that death and go, well, it's either an Ivy League education in psychology or queer studies at Yale, or, you know, trying to kill a bunch of people who don't share my religious beliefs. And once they killed my father, my path was set. That's not how it works. It's how it sounds on television, but that's not how it works. Sooner or later, we have to leave Afghanistan, and we can always go back with drones and rockets and blow the living crap out of them if they get uppity, if they step out of line. If they allow the Taliban to come back into power, they get what they deserve. I will feel badly for the people. They'll be oppressed, especially the women. They will no longer be allowed to learn. They will have to cover themselves from head to toe like it's a Casper the Friendly Ghost fashion show. But that's the life that the people of Afghanistan would have chosen, either actively or passively by sitting by and letting it happen. We should get out of the country. And John Bolton is not in favor of that. President Trump is in favor of that. President Trump is trying to have his cake and eat it too on this, because I think he's being pulled in two directions. His instincts, which are to get out after 18 years, and many of his advisors like John Bolton, who are saying, no, we can't leave because it will be a disaster over there. And I'm not sure people realize that Afghanistan is a disaster. It's never, you don't go back in time and find a point in history where Afghanistan was on the cutting edge of societal evolution, why they were the most modern. No, they never were. They are pretty much the same way they were 2,000 years ago. They have electricity and some internet, and they've learned how to take those little red flowers with the black center and make them into heroin. But other than that, they're pretty much the same. The society, civilization has lapped them on the track of life several thousand times. It's like a foot race between Usain Bolt and Michael Moore, five times around the track. Mike makes it halfway and is winded, while Bolt is drinking Gatorade at the finish line. That's Afghanistan, Michael Moore. So it is time to get out. Yet the palace intrigue is all the story. Is this more evidence of just a disjointed foreign policy? Is this evidence of chaos in the Trump administration? You could see the narratives forming before their vacant eyes in the press corps. And on behalf of every American, I just happen to live here, but every American out in real America, I proudly and completely proclaim, I don't care. He's gone. Who's next? Okay, you're not going to undo it. You're not going to unscrew this situation. John Bolton isn't going to come back, and Donald Trump isn't going to say, please come back. So it's over. Let's get over it. Who cares about the mechanics of it? What does it mean for our military and for our national security? That should be all that matters. That is not all that matters to our media. They want to find a way. They want what they really want because of the conflicting reports. John Bolton was texting Brian Kilmeade on Fox and Friends saying, I wasn't fired, I resigned. And he took to his Twitter account saying, I wasn't fired, I resigned. And the president said, you didn't resign, you were fired. It's right out of a sitcom. You can't fire me, I quit. Well, Who cares? He's gone. Get over it. The palace intrigue, though, is trying to be spun into this is an administration in chaos. My goodness, can you believe it? And they're still using that bogus CNN story from yesterday about the CIA spy in the Kremlin who had to be pulled out, mostly because the media started sniffing around about him and the Obama administration kind of outed him in 2016 or put him at risk. So they took him out in 2017. CNN and most of the mainstream media is trying to say that this was done because of Donald Trump and the Michael and the John Bolton. Michael Bolton. How are we supposed to live without him? The John Bolton resignation is just more evidence of just how far out of whack this administration is when it comes to foreign policy. It was kind of funny. Nancy Pelosi even sort of accidentally defended John Bolton on Twitter yesterday, saying this is an outrage and he's been out, there's more chaos and whatever. Like, really? You want to defend John Bolton? John Bolton loves this country. You don't like people who love this country. Your party doesn't really like this country. Listen to any of the candidates running for president and tell me that they love this country. Tell me that's the impression you walk away with. But when you have an opportunity and you have opportunists, they come together, they clam together like two magnets, two hyper magnets, just snapping together. The only outlet that isn't going with the CNN scoop still is the one that debunked it, by the way. It's the New York Times. They kind of said, no. The president had nothing to do with this person being removed from Russia. It was media sniffing around. And you got NBC News showing up at his house and putting his life in danger, all in the name of pursuing Donald Trump. That was on yesterday's show. You can go and check it out for yourself. But I found it very, very interesting that the story immediately became, did he resign or was he fired? And I know people sitting around in Michigan today, Wednesday nights, I think it's still Wednesday nights, at a euchre tournament in a bar on Detroit's west side, just on the border with Dearborn, but in Detroit, having a euchre tournament. And they couldn't care less. I guarantee you that John Bolton's name will not come. Michael Bolton might actually play on the jukebox. There's no accounting for taste in my old haunts. But nobody cares about who the national security advisor is. And that's really all that matters. Who comes next? Who will it be? I know that the peaceniks are ecstatic that John Bolton is out, and the hawks are very upset that John Bolton is out. But the president is the president. He's the one who won the election. It's time for him to do. And if somebody was working against him, then so be it. And if they just couldn't get along, so be it. Can we just all be adults about this and walk away without everything being a pissing match? Of course, not with the media. Not with the media at all. Speaking of the media, in other political news, there was a special election in North Carolina, and you would have thought that for a House seat in North Carolina, you would have thought that this was the end-all, be-all. This was Trump's re-election or not. The president went down there yesterday. All the media had been camped out. The Democratic challenger, I guess neither one was the incumbent. The Democrat was a media darling. The party had pulled out all the stops. It's amazing how much money these parties piss away on an insignificant election. I'm going to take a big bucket of ice water and dump it all over this special election. In North Carolina's 9th district, Democrat Dan McCready, he was the golden boy. He was chosen. It was over. Dan Bishop, the Republican, why, he was just a proxy for Trump. And the Democrats were going to show that they were going to turn North Carolina, this one seat, turn it blue to show up Donald Trump and stand up for whatever the hell it is they believe at this moment. Well, it didn't work out that way. Dan Bishop, the Republican, won. It was a close race. So what? Low turnout. This is what I get. we're talking about one seat in the House of Representatives. There are 435 voting members in the House of Representatives. There are a couple of other, like Washington, D.C., the Virgin Islands. They have representatives in the House of Representatives, but they don't vote on the floor. They can vote in committee. It's a mess. It's a horrible system, but it is what it is. Eleanor Holmes Norton, you may have heard that name. She represents Washington, D.C., and she sits on committees. And the other representative, like American Samoa, they talk about a waste of money. They always sit around and whine, we need to be a state. We're getting taxation without representation. Yeah, why do you want representation? Shouldn't you be fighting the taxation? You know, we don't need representation. Just stop taxing us and we'll call it a day. Then I might consider moving to one of these places. But they always fight for the wrong thing because liberals love government. Well, this race between Bishop and McCready was billed as this is a litmus test for Donald Trump, much like most other special elections have been billed as litmus tests for Donald Trump. And then when the Republicans win, they all go, well, it was a moral victory for the Democrat because it was much closer than the numbers would have suggested just on paper. Donald Trump won this district by a whole lot. Yeah, okay. Well, it's also in September, right? In a non-election year. There aren't a whole lot of people really super excited to go out and vote in an election in September where there's one thing on the ballot. Just one. So turnout is low. Even if it had gone the other way, whichever way it went, this wouldn't have been a refutation of the president had the Democrat won, and it is not an embrace of the president because the Republican won. They're all going to have to do this all over again because this exact House seat is up again next year, just like everything else. So they'll get a year and a half in the House of Representatives. The only thing is Bishop will now have the power of incumbency behind him, and that should benefit him. But this is a Republican district, and it had nothing whatsoever to do with the balance of power in the House of Representatives. If this were the one seat that was going to determine whether or not Republicans or Democrats controlled the House of Representatives, I could see why this would be considered a big race. But in the grand scheme of things, this is irrelevant. It matters not a whit to anything going on in Washington, in the House of Representatives, and it is not a harbinger of things to come for the 2020 election. The 2020 election will be decided in 2020, not 2019, in a special election in North Carolina. But the media can't help themselves. And I'm not just talking, it's not just MSNBC and CNN, it's all the media. Fox is out there, well, there's a big deal. It's a test for the president. Can he pull this person over? No, this is decided by the people who live in North Carolina's 9th district. They didn't want a Democrat representing them, so they want a Republican representing them. So they got a Republican representing them. Moving on. If the Democrat had won, you would not have heard the end of this. It would be nonstop rejection of Trump, rejection of Trump. And they'll still try and spin it as the margin of victory was so very small that it shows a weakness of President Trump. Except President Trump's name wasn't on the ballot. I don't know why these people can't be honest. It's almost like I have to believe they can't be. Because the truth is so easy. Especially in a case like this. This race is insignificant. Why pretend it's not? And it's wishful thinking. They wanted the Democrat to win so they could say, look at what Donald Trump has done to the Republican. A safe Republican district is now controlled by a Democrat. Oh, it shows just how weak and how not behind the president Republicans are. Now this will be memory hold by Thursday morning. It'll be over. It'll get a light brushing over on MSNBC and CNN tomorrow. Fox will treat it as if it is a big old stick in the eye of Democrats. But by Thursday, people will forget about it. Democrats can have their moral victory. Moral victories are nothing but a polite way of saying you lost. That's all they are. This seat in North Carolina, you will probably not hear the name Dan Bishop again. Honestly, after this week, maybe it'll get a slight mention on the Sunday shows, which technically, based on how calendars are set up, will be next week, but that'll be it. It doesn't matter. It is a desperate media at a time of relatively slow news, looking for things that feed their narratives. This is why I highly recommend you find some shows to watch, to be honest with you. Find some, take a little break. You do yourself so much good if you just, every once in a while, one day a week, you'll find, this is my night of shows. Monday is for me. Monday is my night of shows. You take the Monday and you just watch your shows. It's kind of Sunday night and Monday, because I like Sunday night. I like Ballers on HBO, and I watch Below Deck or Below Deck Mediterranean, and now this renovating of the Brady House. I find that interesting. And American Ninja Warrior. So that's my Sunday night and Monday night. And then I go back to watching cable news, and it does a world of good. It's a mental three-day weekend every week, even though I have to rush and catch up with the rest of the news when I get ready to record. But yes, this race in North Carolina, congratulations to Dan Bishop. He won. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I don't know what else to say about it. MSNBC's hopes were dashed. CNN's hopes were dashed. In that sense, I enjoyed it. But in the grand scheme of things, Nancy Pelosi is still Speaker of the House. That's going to happen at least through the next year. One more body on either side of the aisle doesn't make or break that. And nobody wants to tell you that, because you won't watch their breathless coverage of the exciting possibilities of what this race could be a sign of. It's a sign of what's going on in this particular race in North Carolina, and a sign of the fact that most people don't pay attention or care or vote in special elections. That's all. Speaking of special and elections, I have a clip here from Beto O'Rourke. It's important to remember that Beto O'Rourke is the children of wealth. He comes from money. He's always had money. He's never really had to worry about money. And growing up like that, I have to imagine, does things to your brain, scrambles them a little bit. It affords you the ability to do a lot more drugs when you're younger. That much is clear from Beto. But it also perverts. And then, by the way, he then married the daughter of a billionaire. So Beto went from rich to super rich. This perverts the idea of money in people. They don't understand what it's like to be poor. Yet these liberal Democrats believe that they know what is best for poor people and how poor people live. Why? Because, well, they might have seen a 60 Minutes segment on what it's like for one particular person, chosen because they represent a worst case scenario, and they believe that they must legislate based on that. We must address this epidemic problem that impacts 7 people across the country. We must therefore uproot our entire capitalist system, things like that. That's how you end up in a situation like you have with these Democrats wanting to uproot capitalism, because capitalism didn't work for somebody who didn't apply themselves in school and dropped out, skipped a lot, whatever it is, smoked a lot of dope, drank a lot of beer, and ended up with menial jobs their whole lives. Minimum wage menial jobs. And they think, well, this is a massive injustice. When in fact, it most of the time, 99.99% of the time, people end up in life exactly where they worked themselves to. It's a wildly unpopular theory, but it's true. I am living proof. I and some of my friends are exactly living proof of this. I'll never forget. I went to college right out of high school just because I didn't know what else to do. And I got a one-time scholarship from my elementary school for $1,000. That and the graduation party money that I had was enough to pay for a year's tuition at Wayne State University. And it was cheap. It was a commuter college. It's a big school. Our most famous alum is Casey Kasem. And the S. Apathia something or other, she played on the Law and Order. She was the black police chief or whatever she was, the police boss in there. Those were the two people that went to and Jeffrey Tambor. But he went to the graduate school for acting. And nobody wants to admit it now that he's been run out of town for making fun of trans people or whatever the hell his problem was in the Me Too movement. But that's it. It's a small school. It's a cheap school. I have no idea what it costs now. I imagine it's significantly more than when I was going there, but it wasn't all that much money. So I was able to go for a year, and I went because I didn't know what else to do. I had no idea. The whole plan, my whole life, and it was my parents' model. You go to school, you graduate high school, you get a job, you get married, you retire from that job, and that's it. That's what the career path was that was instilled in me. Well, I went to school for theater for the first year because the chicks were hot and I liked ad-libbing. Then I ran out of money and I realized that acting is a waste of time anyway. You don't need a degree to do it. So I took a few years and smoked a lot of dope, drank a lot of beer, and did a lot of menial jobs. If you're wondering how you get to 70-some-odd jobs in a person's life, that's kind of how you do it. You're not really good at any of them. You're not really interested in any of them. You would work here for 2 weeks, there for a month, here for 1 hour. I held the job for 1 hour. I left one job at lunch and didn't go back. I mean, I was a total loser. But amongst most of my friends, it was normal. That was the life. That was what you did. We worked in independent record stores. We worked in the malls. We did whatever. As long as you had enough beer money to go out or found a way to scrape it together, that was all life was. It was very much for the immediate. And I'll never forget it. I was doing roofing, and I was driving past somebody's house. I don't want to say who. And I thought, well, that person is doing a job that was on par with what I was doing, except they were, a lot of years ahead of me. And I thought, my God, is this what my life is going to be? And I got really depressed. Like, I'm going to be roofing for the next 30 years or longer? Is that what, for $8 an hour, is that what I'm going to be doing? And my girlfriend at the time said, well, why don't you go back to school? And I said, her father was an executive at Ford, and she'd graduated from University of Michigan, and she was pursuing a PhD in pharmacology and toxicology. I've always dated much better looking than I could possibly get in the honor system, and much smarter than I possibly deserve. Married that way, too. And just for the hell of it, I said, I filled out the financial aid forms right out of high school. They said, no. So then I said, all right, I'll fill them out again. And I got the money. I got the Pell Grants and everything because I wasn't making any money at all. And I went back to school. And then I started applying myself. And I said, my God, this is my chance. I can do something else. I always thought I could do more than roof or work in a factory making aluminum brakes, things like that. And I had my chance, and I applied myself, and I busted my ass. And on spring breaks, I would come out to my friends in Baltimore and work for a placement agency on a temporary basis for that week in Washington, D.C., trying to get a feel for what's, going on, and maybe try and get a lead on a job in the future. My other friends, they never went to school. They stayed on the same path. And I remember one of them when I graduated college and I was moving out to Washington to take a job in the bookstore of all places. It was, again, a menial entry-level job. But in my interview, I just said I wanted a foot in the door and I'll wrestle the rest of my body through on my own. My friend said to me, you got really lucky. You got really lucky. And I thought, F you, buddy. I did not get lucky. I made a conscious decision and then worked my ass off for it. He made a conscious or unconscious decision not to do anything, to sort of float and drift, and he's still floating and drifting and whatever he's doing now. I hope he's happy, but I did not get lucky. I made a series of decisions and stuck to it, even when it sucked, when it was finals time and all my friends were going out. I couldn't go out because I had to take my finals, except for my sociology final, which I was an hour and a half late for. But sociology was a joke, and I got to be in the class, having attended like 5 or 6 of them throughout the semester. Don't ever major in sociology. It was a requirement. But that is what happens to people who are poor, who don't have or come from money, who don't have the mindset of somebody. If you come from money, you're going to school. It's a matter of which school you're going to. You're going to a good high school already, or maybe you're going to a boarding school or a private school. It's a different mentality. So there is no way on God's green earth that Beto O'Rourke has one freaking clue what it's like to be poor, what it's like to go to the gas station and put down a bunch of change and say, give me $5.43 on pump 7. Most people do. So when you hear Beto, and see, I didn't forget where I was going with this, even though it probably sounded like it. When you hear Beto in this clip, you hear somebody who wants to tell people how to live, who thinks he knows how it, what it's like to be poor. You remember the book Nickeled and Dimed? It was this wildly popular book in the late 90s or mid 2000s, whenever it was. I can't remember when. I never read it, but I know about it. And it was this reporter who got a big advance to go and write a book about what it's like to be struggling in America, to be living paycheck to paycheck. Now, she didn't live paycheck to paycheck. She was making a nice living and then getting a nice chunk of change from her publisher to write this book also helped. But she played poor. It was poverty tourism. She became, I think it was a waiter, and she tried to live on tips. She was in some diner in some town somewhere, and she played poor for a little while. But she always had in her wallet 2 credit cards. In case things got really bad, she had an escape hatch, which if you're truly poor, if you're truly living paycheck to paycheck, and as somebody who has lived paycheck to paycheck and not made it from paycheck to paycheck and had to sell things to make it that week, you don't have a parachute in real life. Yet, it was a wild smash, this book, with liberals, and they tried to legislate based on it. It was the talk of the gab shows on cable news, and oh my goodness, isn't this an amazing experiment she did? Look at how tough it is to be poor in America. And it's like, no, you have no idea what it's like to be poor. Because if you get a hankering for a steak in week 3 of your deep dive undercover research and your poverty tourism, you can go into your purse, go to Morton's, and bust out the credit card and say, well, I'll just have one of these. Maybe she didn't do it, but the ability to do it impacts your mentality. If you're just toughing it through to be poor, most people who don't make a lot of money are wildly happy in this country. They don't have, at least the ones I know, as long as they're able to keep a roof over their head, keep food in their family's table, have a couple of beers with friends, or go see a movie every once in a while, or whatever, they don't sit around and not everybody wants to be a Kardashian. Oh, those are the squeaky wheels, and they definitely get the grease. But most people just want to be left the hell alone. They want to be able to have their simple lives, spend time with their family and friends, have an occasional adult beverage every now and then, have some fun, live it up, go camping for a week or whatever. They don't feel oppressed because somebody else is flying private and using $100 bills as toilet paper. They mostly think those people are crazy and stupid and wasteful. But, by the way, if you got a private jet and you want to fly me around the world, email me. But to listen to Beto, we're getting to Beto. I swear we're getting to Beto. This is just a topic about which it bothers me a whole lot. Getting to Beto, he's talking to a group of what looks like college students. And he's talking about how we're going to have to essentially remake society. We're going to have to herd everybody into major cities, is the gist of what he's saying. Because we can no longer have a society where the rich live with the rich and the poor live with the poor. They all have to live piled on top of each other because it's greener, but also because it's more fair. Because Beto thinks that there are people on this planet, in this country, in this year, right now, who will drive an hour in each direction to and from work for a minimum wage job. That's not, it, maybe there is. You can probably find 10 or 12 people per state who fit this description. But Beto is so out of touch with reality and so clueless as to what it's like to not have money that he paints this picture of a fantasy world where people are driving an hour in both directions to go someplace and make $7.25 an hour. That's not how it works. Yet he's convinced himself that that's how it works, or at least how it works for enough people that we must completely and totally remake our society and our culture and nation to address what he views as a problem. Of course, it's not a problem if you've decided to drive it 2 hours a day to make $45 or whatever it is, an 8-hour day and a minimum wage. That's on you. That's your problem. That's your bad choices. I guess it'd be like $56 minus tax, whatever. Anyway, listen to little Beto here.
Here's a tough thing to talk about, though we must. Rich people are going to have to allow or be forced to allow lower income people to live near them, which is what we fail to do in this country right now. We force lower income working Americans to drive 1, 2, 3 hours in either direction to get to their jobs, very often minimum wage jobs, so they're working 2 or 3 of them right now. What if, as we propose to do, we invested in housing that was closer to where you work, very often mixed income housing, meaning the very wealthiest are living next to those who are not the very wealthiest in this country, to make sure that they can both afford to go to the same public schools, that we really have that as a place where in this divided country right now, you can come together without regard to your income or your race or your ethnicity or any other difference that should not matter right now. What if we invested, as we propose to do, in high-speed rail and in transit in all of our cities to make sure that if you do not have a car or do not want to use a car, you will not need to have one or you will not be penalized for not having one right now. So having cities that are smarter, that are denser, that have people living closer to where they work and where their families are, to reduce our impact on climate change and greenhouse gas emissions, but also just to improve the quality of life in these built environments, that's an extraordinary opportunity. In our plan to confront climate change, we make those investments. Thank you for asking. Appreciate it.
It was even dumber than I remembered. Up to 3 hours. Yeah, if you're driving 3 hours to a minimum wage job and you have 2 or 3 of them, how in the hell are you? There's only 24 hours in a day, Beto. I don't think your math works out there very well. But this is the left. This is somebody who's never really had to worry about money, acting as though he knows what is best for people who don't have any. We're going to herd you all together. We're going to put, yeah, this is going to work out well. What is going to happen to people who don't want to move? Well, no, you don't understand. We've got to do it. It's for the environment at the end. He ties all this insanity, this 5-year Soviet-style plan of moving people to cities and putting poor people next to rich people. One of the benefits of actually working and becoming successful is being able to live in a nicer neighborhood. It's what should be used as motivation to people who live in not so nice neighborhoods, right? Shouldn't it be? Say, look, if you work really hard, if you study hard in school, if you don't screw around, if you make good choices instead of bad choices, you can end up here too. Not that you will, but you can. You have this opportunity. And it should be, it used to be used to inspire people. Now it's used as a cudgel. Now it's used as a weapon. Those people over there in those nice houses, it's unfair that they have nice houses. Yeah, sure, they went to high school and studied and went to college and then to law school or medical school and did a lot of crap jobs along the way, and they finally have earned a big slice of their own pie. And no, it used to be something you'd celebrate. Now it's they don't deserve it. It's unfair that they have more than that. Well, there's not a bus going around that is the government that gives out slices of pie to people, the slices of the economic pie, and it's just a crapshoot. The matter of, you go up to the good humor man and you say, let me have a slice of that pie. And if he's in a good mood and you happen to strike him in a nice way, well, here's a big heaping helping of it. We're going to even pile some whipped cream on top of it. Good for you. You get the private yacht and the beachfront house and all that stuff. And then the next person says, could I have a slice? I'd like a slice of that pie too. And you know what? I don't care for the cut of your jib, kid. Here you go. Here's a crumb. Now move along. That's not the way the world works. It's not the way this country works. Terry Crews, the actor from Brooklyn Nine-Nine, I think he was Terry Tate, office linebacker back in the 2000s, which was a great series of commercials. Famous guy. He was on an Adam Carolla podcast now probably 5 years ago. I don't know. I know why this stuck with me, because it's absolutely brilliant, and I wish that I had thought of it. He came up from nothing, and now he's making millions of dollars. A very famous, successful actor. Comedic actor. Funny as all get out. Built. I think he used to be a professional football player, or should have been, because he's built like one. He was talking about some of his relatives, if I remember this correctly, and they were sitting around bitching about how they aren't getting their own piece of the pie, and they need this and they need that. And this is back when he was, you know, poor, when he wasn't rich, at least. And they're sitting around with people bitching about not having their own piece of the pie and how it's unfair this and unfair that. And Terry said, no, this is the mentality that traps people in poverty, that traps people generationally, because you pass this down generation to generation in poverty. He says, the United States doesn't owe you a piece of the pie. The United States isn't a bakery where you go in and buy or get your own slice of pie. The United States is a kitchen where you can make your own pie. You can make it as big as you can possibly make it. You can make it as small as you possibly want to make it. Whatever it is, you get access to all the ingredients to make your own pie. And if you do it, and you do it right, and you make a good pie, congratulations. If you don't bother baking anything, or you just, you know, throw a couple of dusts of flour and some water together for a crust and slap an apple on it, that's what you get. Life is what you make of it. But if you're born wealthy, if you never really had to work for anything in your life, you end up like Beto, where you see you don't understand what poverty is like. You don't understand that poverty does not equal misery. Not having something leads to jealousy, and Democrats definitely exploit the hell out of that, but it doesn't lead to misery. It can lead to some tough times depending on what happens to you in life. But what happens to you in life is 9 times out of 10 or 99 times out of 100 the result of the decisions that you made along the way. Did you skip a lot of school? Were you having a lot of sex and drinking a lot when you should have been studying, when you should have been going to class? You might have some great stories from high school and some wonderful anecdotes from the 2 years you went to junior college. But where are you now? What did you do with the opportunities you had? That's what life is. That's what Democrats desperately want to insulate and inoculate people from, the consequences of their actions. Not everybody's life is meant to be led as a shining example, leading forward on how everybody else should be. Sometimes some people's lives are meant to be cautionary tales. I can say that because I've led both. I'm not quite the one with the lantern leading up the dark corridor and lighting the way for other people, but I'm a hell of a lot closer to that than when I was the cautionary tale, because believe me, I was a cautionary tale and I was certainly on that path for a cautionary tale until a girlfriend kicked me in the ass and said, you need to stop being depressed about this and do something about it, because the mentality that my old friend that I was talking about earlier has is the mentality that I had. And I mentioned this on the show before, but it's worth mentioning again because there's a lot of new people listening. I would sit around doing whatever. I was a busboy. I was a waiter. I was a cook. You name it. I've done it. When you've had, someday I'm going to pull up my jobs list and go through it. But when you've had as many jobs as most families have had, you've done it all. And I'd sit around and be angry at various times, going, I could do better than this. I knew I could do better than this. I knew I was definitely smarter than being a busboy at Blakeney's Ranch House on Grand River and 8 Mile, right just past where they cross. I knew I could do better than that. But I was waiting around for somebody else to make it happen for me. I was waiting around for somebody. I don't know who. I mean, this was a cheap place. Not cheap. Like, I mean, the food was fine, but it was not in a nice neighborhood. It was not in a rich neighborhood. I wasn't working at the Morton's there. I was bussing tables at Blakeney's Ranch House. And I would sit around and think, somebody, I'll make a comment, I'll make a crack when I'm taking somebody's dishes away or cleaning a table next to somebody. Somebody is going to recognize that there's more in me than just being a busboy or when I was a waiter. Somebody will, I'll charm these people and they'll, some CEO of some massive company, although I never worked any place where any CEOs would come, but somebody will go, my God, kid, I've been watching you, I've been listening to you, and I saw the way you served me food. I have to say that you're the most brilliant person I've ever met, and I need you to come and work for me, and I need to pay you a lot of money to do that. There really is that mentality. You're angry that you're not getting your breaks while you're doing nothing to manufacture your own breaks, to do anything. And you can either become angrier or you can wake the hell up and go, you know what? The United States is a kitchen. America is a kitchen. I'm going to have to make my own pie. Nobody's going to tap me on the shoulder and say, we're here with Publishers Clearinghouse. Here's a ton of money and a great opportunity. We're going to help you along the way. Nope. Opportunity comes along, and it's an old adage. It is a cliche because it's true. You're as lucky as you're the more you work, the luckier you get. The harder you work, the luckier you get. So when you hear someone like any of these Democrats talk about how unfair this country is, how stacked the deck is, how rigged the system is, these people are the ones who are discouraging people from trying. They're telling people, don't bother trying. You can't get ahead. No matter what you do, the system is rigged against you because of your sexual orientation, your skin color, or your socioeconomic status at birth. There's no point in trying to get ahead. Ignore all the people who got ahead, you know, in very similar or identical or even worse circumstances than you. That was a fluke. That was the anomaly. They think that you want to go from making $7.25 an hour to being a billionaire. And they forget that everything else is in between. All you really want to do is do better. Do good enough. There are people for whom making $50,000 a year would be more than enough. And they would be ecstatic. And then there are people who would like to make millions of dollars a year. And there are people who are working their asses off to try and make millions of dollars a year. And when they do it, they suddenly become the enemy of the Democratic Party. Unless they become an appendage of the Democratic Party and a patron of the Democratic Party, then suddenly those rich people aren't so bad, after all. But it just drives me nuts to hear somebody like Beto talk about how he knows what it's like. And he, clearly, driving 3 hours to a minimum wage job, if you're making that kind of bad decision in your life, then your life is bad because of you. And for no other reason than you. And if you're looking to a politician to come along and save you, be it Beto, Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden, Pete Buttigieg, Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, any of them, anybody, even Donald Trump, if you're looking for a politician to come along and make your life better, your life is never going to be better. You're the only one who can do it. I'm going to step off the high horse here before I end up doing the last half of the show on this topic, but it just drives me nuts. Actually, I have two stories here that are along this same line, and it involves Democrats and how they're just screwing up places that don't have to be screwed up. The first one is the state of California, the Sacramento Bee. A new law signed by Gavin Newsom bans school from suspending disruptive kids. You think, oh, what? What? How are you going to ban a school? Why would you ban a school from suspending disruptive kids? This is actually more common across the country than you know. They did it in Baltimore a few years ago. It will soon be illegal in California for both public and charter schools to suspend disruptive kids from kindergarten through eighth grade. Governor Gavin Newsom on Monday signed into law Senate Bill 419, which permanently prohibits willful defiance suspensions in grades 4 and 5. It also bans such suspensions in grades 6 through 8 for 5 years. The law goes into effect July 1st, 2020. The previous law, they already couldn't suspend them through third grade. No matter how disruptive a kid is, you have to keep them in class. This is how insane it is. Senator Nancy Skinner, Democrat from Berkeley, of course, who wrote the law, said it would, quote, keep kids in school where they belong and where teachers and counselors can help them thrive, end quote. What about the parents? Where are the parents in all of this? The parents don't factor into this at all. The government is the parent now in a place like California. And with the massive homeless problem and drug problem and illegal alien crime problem, you can see the parents are doing gangbusters. California students missed more than 150,000 days of school because of suspensions for unruly behavior in 2016 and 17. According to the California Senate analysis, Skinner and other supporters of the bill argued that students of color are disproportionately affected by such suspensions. Why wouldn't you then say, well, why are they being suspended? Well, they did. And the answer, of course, that they found without looking, they just assigned it, is it's racism. The students of color are being suspended more frequently because of racism, not, you know, maybe bad parenting, because the government is the parent. There are bad parents out there. They are of all color, including people of color. So just pretending that it has nothing to do with parents is now going to punish students who are there to learn, students from good families whose parents care about their education, including children of color. But they don't care. They don't ascribe to the idea that a rising tide lifts all boats. They believe that a lowering tide sinks all boats. Sooner or later, if we can just lower the bar and make sure that nobody gets an education, then suddenly everybody will be educated at all the same level, and we will have equality. Because socialism, communism, fascism, they aren't about raising people up. They're about lowering the top down. So kids who go to school, who want to learn, and are being disrupted by unruly kids who don't get a whole lot of discipline at home, are now going to have no sanctuary from those kids, which is kind of ironic in a sanctuary state, to be perfectly honest with you. But they're not allowed to be taken out of class anymore. Now the teacher is going to be monopolized by the kid who likes to talk, likes to swear, likes to throw things, likes to hit other kids, has no interest, has no discipline. Now, I'm sure there are all sorts of reasons for that, but you can't separate out those kids because that would be unfair to those children. You couldn't possibly ever suspend them if they get violent or defiant. I love that. Defiant. Sit down. No. Sit down. No, I will not sit down. And suddenly, you know, the arrow in the quiver for a teacher to get back control of their class, the suspension, is now taken away by the state and snapped in half. That's liberalism in action. Skinner and other supporters of the bill argued that students of color, blah, 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 SB 419 may be one of the best ways to disrupt the school-to-prison pipeline, Skinner said. The school-to-prison pipeline. You might want to think, rather than society doing it, you might want to go, well, why are these schools sending these kids in this series of pneumatic tubes directly to prison? Maybe it's not that simple. Maybe it's a series of, again, bad choices made by these kids. And then as they go into adulthood, since they've been coddled their whole lives rather than actually disciplined, not just by schools who should be instilling discipline in them, but by parents, that maybe that's why they end up in prison. Maybe that's more of the problem. SB was praised by civil rights activist Dolores Huerta, who said in a statement that, quote, I strongly believe that SB 419 will bring justice to California youth by eliminating suspension for disruption and defiance, putting an end to discriminatory discipline policies, and instituting restorative justice practices. Restorative justice, economic justice, social justice, racial justice, you name it. They bring about stupidity at every turn leftists do, and then they just slap justice at the end of it, and everybody goes back to their gated communities where they aren't directly impacted by any of this crap, sip their tea with their pinkies out, and feel very, very accomplished and proud of themselves over what they have done. California is already a hellhole. California is digging deeper and deeper. Every time you think the left has hit bottom, they break out a backhoe and they just keep digging. Then you go to Baltimore. Very similar situation. The Baltimore Sun is editorializing in favor of this. In some parts of Baltimore, violence and death are a normal part of life. Children see dead bodies and hear gunshots ring out on a regular basis. I can vouch for that. Been there, saw it all in Baltimore. Well, now there's a member of the city council, City Councilman Zeke Cohen, who, if you don't know who Zeke Cohen is, I highly recommend you find some of his appearances on television. He is a left-wing nut. He wants to bring about trauma coaches in the city. He wants to make Baltimore into a, quote, trauma-responsive city. We stand behind the idea, the Sun editorializes, which would have employees at all level of government take into account a person's traumatic background. Teachers work to calm students down and figure out what's going on in their lives to make them act out rather than throw them out of class. Again, what are you doing to the rest of the students in class? You're ignoring them. Because the disruptive student, no matter what their situation may be, and I have no doubt that kids in Baltimore have seen some shit, then they're going to need some help, some counseling, some special attention. You can't give them special attention anymore because you can't take them out of class. You can't put them in special classes because, my God, that would just make them feel otherized. If you take them out of the normal classes and put them in special classes, that's like re-traumatizing them again. So instead, if you just screw over everybody, then nobody learns, rather than, you know, dealing with the situation with a disruptive child. The same could be said about instructors in the city's recreation centers. Find a kid help rather than send them back to the streets because he gets too upset over losing a basketball game. Police can de-escalate rather than pull a gun and worsen a situation. Social workers help connect families to counseling rather than remove kids from parents. Well, honestly, some of those kids need to be removed from parents. Some of these kids would be better off. And you're asking police to de-escalate a psychopath, maybe with a gun, try and make nice with them, rather than protect themselves and the other members of the community? This is why Baltimore is a hellhole. There's a place for this. There is a place for something like this. I'm not a complete heartless bastard, just mostly. But for this to be the plan, and that's what they're advocating here in the Baltimore Sun. They're saying, find out how much this costs and then make sure the money is there. Don't worry about whether or not there are other more effective ways. That children actually need discipline. Most children actually crave some kind of discipline. And if they're acting out in school, you're probably not. Talk to a teacher. Talk to somebody who's a teacher or somebody who recently retired as a teacher. My father-in-law recently retired as a teacher. They can tell you stories of you disciplining a child who is disruptive, who is out of control, not suspending, but offering any kind of disruption or any kind of criticism to the parents. And the calls that they get from the parents, how dare you single out Jimmy just because he stuck a pencil in the back of a hand of some other student? This is your responsibility. It is your kid from 8 until 3. You deal with it. Don't send him home with a note and expect me to come in. I'm not taking off work to come in and talk to you. This is more common than you could possibly know. So all these liberal, excuse the analogy, but these band-aids on a bullet wound are not going to deal with the root cause of the problem. The democratic philosophy, it's just going to empower them further. if you live in one of these areas, I highly recommend you move. Don't subject your kids to that. Homeschooling is an option. And that's probably what we're going to do with our kids, at least for a while, till hopefully we can afford to live someplace where we'd send our kids to the schools. Damn, I went long again. That is all the time we have for today. You can email me, Derek@dailycaller.com. You can enter to win, if you want to, the Sean Parnell book. You should want to. You should buy it. If you did buy it, send me a copy of your receipt or a picture of you holding the book or some kind of proof that you're not standing in a Barnes & Noble with the book or taking a picture from Amazon of the book, and you'll be entered twice for a signed copy of Sean Parnell's book. Otherwise, I'll see you on, Thursday. It's already Wednesday today. Damn, time is flying. Sorry, I didn't even get to commemorate 9/11. I went off on my long rant. But on last year's show on 9/11, I told my story of where I was and how angry I was that day. You can go back and listen to that one or whatever. But remember, never forget, as much as the left wants you to, never forget 9/11. I'll see you on Thursday.
We force lower-income working Americans to drive 1, 2, 3 hours in either direction to get to their jobs, very often minimum wage jobs.